Crumb.
I'm ready over here. You ready over there?
I was born ready.
All right, let's kick it off, guys. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Cromcast. Are you guys going to believe it? It's a 10-year anniversary. It's an 18th season. We've come of age. We're full grown. We're grown adults.
Oh, boy.
I am brimming with excitement. I can't stand it. I can't stand it. This is exciting.
It's feeling comfortable right now, like a well-worn chair.
You're in there. You're kind of rolling wiggling back around. And forth. Yeah. You're like Han Solo in the Falcon.
Yeah, you're getting your cheeks where they go.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, it just slides right in there.
Yep.
Man, all right. What are we talking about, guys?
Hither came Conan.
Oh, are we returning?
Again. Yeah,
we're back. We're back on the Road of Kings Redux. We're back in the Hyborian Age, and we're back with Conan. Back where we started from 10 mighty long years ago.
And it feels so good.
It does feel good. Yeah. The 10-year thing feels good. Doing Conan again. Getting on Howard again. I know we put him in everywhere we can.
But yeah. We pepper him in. But yeah. this is full-throated. We're going like a full Howard season.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And we can't be accused of going back to the well. I mean, 10 years is enough time, right? Like if this was a cold case.
I think we've proven that we're willing to podcast about just about any author, right. Just about any book.
Yep. Yeah. And maintaining the Howard focus. But we're coming back to a focus on Howard like through and through. So we're gonna talk about the Phoenix on the Sword. That's what we got in store tonight. Today,
I'm so excited.
This morning, whatever time you're listening to this podcast, maybe it's the wee hours of the midnight.
The Stygian darkness all around
it's
you.
It's the 11th hour. It's the 3 a.m. You're out driving on a desolate highway. We're gonna talk to you.
What, one of my dream podcast listeners, like you talking about being on the highway in the middle of the night, I hope a lighthouse keeper listens to us somewhere in the world. Like that's my dream.
So reach out if you're a lighthouse keeper.
Yeah, if you are, that'd be awesome.
Let's talk about what it is that we're doing and why it is that we're doing it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. Maybe also I would lay out, like, let's establish some rules, because we've kind of talked about this off mic, but what we're doing as far as, like, rules for ourselves, not rules for the listeners, anybody that's on board with this, you can do what you want, but I think for us, I think it would be healthy to kind of lay out, like, how we're going to approach things. Mm-hmm. So why are we doing this, guys?
Well, I think from my perspective, 10 years is a big anniversary. And we started with this character and these stories, and it would be fun to revisit them. Like, we want to do fun stuff. Many of these stories, it's been 10 years since we've read.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. There's a fair number that I've not returned to over the past decade, which is kind of crazy to say, but we've been reading a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. For the show, and we've been reading a lot of stuff for outside of the show. So yeah, a lot of stories to get back to.
And when we first approached them, we had never read most of them, or any of them in some cases, right?
And never made a podcast before.
And if you listen to that first episode, you can tell that. But now, I think it would be cool to talk about these not as Conan and Howard neophytes, but as seasoned veterans. Like we're the old guys now.
It's true.
Kinda.
I do like that idea of we picked Conan and Howard. We picked Howard and then we picked Conan because it's the heavy, right?
Yeah.
That's the guy that everybody knows. And so that's what we came to the table with for our show when we started. And now bringing 10 years of experience to wait on the character will be a lot of fun and kind of revelatory, I think.
Yeah,
for us.
And the world's changed, right? Yeah. In the words of the gunslinger and Stephen King, the world's moved on, right? Like, and sword and sorcery writ large has become a burgeoning kind of like it's a phoenix. It's rising up from the ashes, like to try to invoke that kind of that symbol. It's something that's coming about more in a full fashion than when we were doing the show at the outset. I mean, there was a lot of grimdark. There was a lot of historical fiction, and there was sword and sorcery being written at that point in time. But in the current year, it is something that's coming about even more. There's a lot of course, like small and amateur press efforts, but there's a lot of like big press efforts too. So it seems smart to kind of return to this. And I don't know. I'm just excited to like revisit stories and see what I think about them now and to talk about them with you guys with that decade of like hindsight. You know, it's 2020, right? Like we can think about what we've seen and kind of look backwards, and that's cool.
I think that's cool. Now, as far as rules, we're not going to listen to the initial episodes.
Yep.
Off the table.
It's off the table. You guys can. They're hard to get. They're not in our feed anymore. You can go to our website, thecrimecast.blogspot.com, and there's a link to a Google Drive folder that has all of them for you. So you can download them all in one fell swoop.
Or if you're totally barbaric, you can go to archive.org and just sort of like surf through archive and find the Chromecast and sort by date, reverse. And then you're going to have them all there too.
That's right.
But that's our feed. Like that's how we've kind of maintained things. But yeah, go to the G Drive. You can get to them there, and they're rough, man. Cause we were working with a microphone inside of a milk crate with a couple towels hanging over it to sort of mute it down. And we were hollering into a milk crate. That's what we were doing.
That is what we were doing.
And now, of course, a decade and a pandemic and a life later, we've all gone through some things and people have moved out of state and back and that kind of thing. Like we've gone through all of that.
Kids.
It'll just be fun to kind of come back to these stories with our insights. You know, we started when we were 25 to 30 and now we're 35 to 40. Mm-hmm. A lot of reading, a lot of thinking, a lot of aging. It'll be fun. How are you guys going to approach keeping like records for this season?
Well, I've got my a whole bunch of pocket size notebooks, and I've been using these more or less as part of my everyday carry for a couple of years now. And so I've got one that's just especially for Chromecast. And when I get to the end of it, I'm going to start a fresh one. So I'm not starting a fresh one yet. Okay. I've got a few pages. It looks like I was using this in season 14. Okay. So I just turned to Cotton Comes to Harlem. But I'm going to fill this up and then I'm going to start a new one. And every story that I read, I want to understand two things. What was going on in Howard's life and what makes the story sword and sorcery.
Nice.
So those are the two big questions I want to ask.
John, how are you taking notes and kind of prepping up?
I was thinking about this back to the old days about how I used to take notes, and I always used to write down the cast of characters and like a little blurb about who they were and what they did. And I would write down any sort of historical precedents that I could find. And I also, when I was flipping through, I found one of my old notebooks from the Solomon Kane season.
Nice.
I would write down all of the comic books that I could figure out.
Right.
The story had been adapted to. And then any sort of like brain collapse that I'd had reading it. This time around, I think I'm going to do some of the same. But I also am considering making a drawing for each, like of the title of some sort. I'll see what happens. I used to do like a little doodle for each one in my notebook, but we'll see what happens this time.
Nice.
I've been getting the pens and inks out a little more lately. So how about you?
So I have my notebook from season one. I got it. It's a spiral bound. Yeah. And I didn't necessarily take notes while we were on the mics. That's something that I've moved towards kind of as we've kind of moved along. And my note-taking has varied from season to season. But at least in the first, you know, a few years, I was pretty diligent about keeping some good records, similar to what you described, John, with having like major characters, themes, talking points, blah, blah, blah. So my intention is to use the old notebook, but I'm going to use sort of like a different colored ink. And then just like that way I can kind of distinguish between, notes that I made the first time around versus this time around, things that stood out to me. The notes that I took for this story our first time around were about half of a page just in a 5-subject notebook. And then I had, you know, about another page on top of that of things that were like different and sort of stood out to me. Sweet. So that's what I'm going to do is try to like resurrect the old notebook and use that just as a way to be able to like see what I was thinking then versus what I'm thinking now.
It's like a little time capsule to write in.
I'm a weirdo, dude.
No, I'm not a weirdo. It's, well, yeah. I have a shoebox. Yeah, I have a shoebox full of real tiny notebooks that I sometimes get out and look at. So yeah, no, that is an awesome way to understand how you've grown over 10 years.
I think it'll be fun. I love looking at my old notes from classes and that kind of thing. I can find little nuggets, and it takes me back. I remember exactly the moment when I was like recopying my notes, studying for a class. I like that feel.
Mm-hmm. Now, our approach since the first season and those early episodes has changed quite a bit. Back then, we would give more or less a beat for beat rehash of the story.
Yeah.
And that's no longer how we do things.
Yeah. And we kind of talked about like major talking points sort of across the plot. It wasn't a recap per se, but it was very much following the beats of the story. Mm-hmm. And here's the things. And sometimes we might have defaulted to a little bit of recapping. I would opt more for our contemporary style, which is like, we'll pick 3 or 4 things that we each think is important, sort of go around the horn. The onus is on the listener if you want to, you know, be on top of the story to read the story ahead of time or to be familiar with it so that context is there.
Yeah. But if you have not read the story by the time you listen to us talk about it, we will spoil it. And so it is possible that there's folks out there that are coming to the Conan stories for the very first time. That was us 10 years ago.
Yep.
So we will talk about major plot points in these stories, and we will give things away.
I would absolutely advocate myself for a spoilery discussion from the outset. Let's not do any sort of like non-spoilers versus spoilers separation.
Yeah.
Like from the outset, we're going to talk about the story whole hog, you know, start to finish, intent, content, characters, blah, 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 all of it at once. Let's do that.
I like it.
What do you think about that, John?
It's an excellent way to go about it. Yeah. Sounds like we have a plan.
I think we do have a plan.
I like it. I'm excited, man. This is we're men on a mission here. We're going to talk about the very first Conan story published. It's an interesting story. Of course, we've talked about it at some point before, but before we get to that, what are we drinking here, guys?
I had some of your coffee. I don't know. Is it Kirkland brand again?
It is not. I'm going to spoil my one thing. I bookmarked it because I can't remember it. It is Pitar. It's the IKEA coffee. I've got an early morning tomorrow, so I'm going to chug a lug on some coffee. I actually made like a 12-cupper, and so I've got the thermos here, and then I've got like the thermos like on reserve for in the morning, and I'm gonna have them stacked. But it's the IKEA coffee, which is pretty dang good.
It's pretty tasty. Yeah.
Yeah. So we got that.
Thank you for sharing.
You're more than welcome. And Josh, if you want some too.
Is there an umlaut in Pitar?
There's a couple, I think, actually. Okay. Over both, it's like P-A-T-A-R, I think, and okay. I think there's umlauts over both of the A's.
I'm just putting dots over everything.
Just dot umlauts for days with the Z's. So that's that's coffee. That's what I have. And then, Josh, what did you bring?
I brought Maker's Mark. I bought this bottle just before Christmas. And the label makes it look like it's wearing a very festive sweater.
Yeah, it's very cute.
Oh, yeah. You got the Christmas edition. Yeah. I love it, dude. Yeah. Nice. So,
happy holidays.
Nice. And I've got the back end of a Christmas bottle of Maker's 46, actually, serendipitously.
Nice.
Josh and I both were rolling with the Samuels family, and we got some of that. So
The red wax is evocative of the blood in this story.
That's true.
That's why you brought it, right?
Well, yeah. to be honest, before I went on a tour of Maker's Mark, I wasn't a big Maker's Mark guy.
Yeah.
And after the tour and seeing the place and tasting it there and tasting some of their higher proof and like the 46, and then them just basically saying, okay, go back wherever you want and take pictures. It's such a stark contrast to how locked down everything is in distillery tours at Wild Turkey and at Woodford. And I don't know, there's just something about that trip that unlocks something in my palate, I think. Like, the more I have, the more Maker's Mark I have, the more it becomes one of my faves. And the price on it has come down, which is not common.
Right.
Right, that's not common. But like with the Kroger discount, a bottle of Maker's Mark can be $22 or $24.
Yep. I think I got the 46 for $26, and mm-hmm. it was a holiday special. Yeah, man, Maker's is no joke. Especially any of their the cask finished, like the stave finished, that's what they call it, because they put the staves inside the barrel. They're tasty as hell, man. Any of those private selects, you cannot buy I don't want
to. You'd be hard pressed.
You would be hard pressed outside of buying Russell's Reserve single barrel or the Knob Creek single barrels, mm-hmm. like that. Those two, and then the Maker's Mark private selects. That's the wheelhouse, man. That's the you want to buy a $50 to $80 bottle of bourbon that's high proof and really tasty. That's it, man. But the cask finish stuff is delicious. And regular old Maker's, it's just straight up nice weeded bourbon. It's delish, dude.
It's good. Yeah. Yeah. I like it more and more.
I'm a little worried that when both of you said the words Wild Turkey, your eyes darted to me almost instinctively. Like I was going to be offended or something.
We thought,
I don't work there.
Well, I didn't want you to channel.
Pull out a switchblade.
Right. Yeah. McConaughey from True Detective.
I'm going to call Jimmy Russell tomorrow.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's what I brought. That's what I've got.
So we got coffee and Maker's Mark. I love it. That's what we're drinking. You guys want to do a quick little one thing?
Yeah, let's do a quick one.
Who's going to lead us off? John, are you ready?
Yeah, you picked me up for the drink part, so I'll go first on this one. In a similar sword and sorcery vein, I have recently picked up some European Mickey Mouse comics. Yeah. A friend of the show, Ignacio, would probably be quite keen on these. Massimo De Vita is the author and cartoonist for them, and they're called the Ice Sword Saga. And it's Mickey and Goofy being magically transported to a sort of Niflheim, Asgard type area.
Holy moly. Yeah. That sounds epic.
Yeah, it is. It is very epic. It's two volumes. I'm closing in on finishing the second one. Very wonderfully illustrated. Not like a Barks or a Rosa type look to it, like the Duck comics, but a little more of a cartoony line. It doesn't look like Walt Disney drew it, which I was into. And a really cool sort of sword and sorcery tale, low magic, but lots of hijinks. If you've ever wanted to try out some of them, there's a Disney Masters volume coming out through Fantagraphics, and they're all very wonderfully packaged and very well presented and translated. So I never thought I would be reading Mickey Mouse comics, but I guess when you run out of everything else.
I love it, dude.
Yeah, you start picking it up. So there's a lot of cool European ones, I'm told, where they're very adventurous. It's not all gag a minute. It's more of a serious sort of story.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So check it out.
That's awesome.
I like that you describe it as low magic and hijinks.
Yes.
Hijinks. Have you guys ever played the Super Nintendo game Magical Quest starring Mickey Mouse?
I haven't. No.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yes.
Where you get he's got the hat and he can shoot magic from it. It's
Oh, the Fantasia hat.
No. It's more like a turban.
Uh-huh.
With a gem in the middle of it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, I have no idea.
Yeah, when you're full hearts, you can transform into the wizard or I think a fireman. And there's another one, but I can't think of it. And it's just a side scrolly platformy game. But your description of that made me think of
Yeah, I
of
can this. See why.
And, Pete is a an evil wizard and
Pete.
Mickey is trying to rescue Pluto.
No peg leg Pete in these. They fight this guy called the Prince of Mists, and he can use his mental powers to make his imaginary illusions real, and the only way to defeat them is to have Goofy in front, because he's sort of brain dead, so he doesn't believe in any of it, and they all disappear. It's a lot of fun. So.
That sounds fun.
Is Josh up next? Is that
Josh is.
All right. My one thing is a video game that is not the Mickey Mouse game, but now I want to play that. This is called Hollow Knight. Have you guys played Hollow Knight?
No, but the grad students all have stickers on their water bottles of Hollow Knight.
Really?
And I'm intrigued. Are there bug things?
It's all bug things.
Yeah, okay.
You're a bug. You're some kind of you've got some horns on your head, so you kind of look like a stag beetle maybe. Okay. But you're anthropomorphic, so you walk on two legs and you've got two arms, and I don't know if you have other limbs and they're hidden or not. It could be. But it's a platformer Metroidvania kind of game. Have you played it yet?
I haven't. That's been on my list of like rando Metroidvanias to pick up for a little while, and I haven't yet.
You'd like it.
Yeah.
Switch had a Christmas, like a holiday winter sale.
Right.
And I picked that up and a couple of these like these Nintendo arcade games. So I got Punch Out and Donkey Kong to play on my Switch. But Hollow Knight, I've put several hours in, and it feels like a post-apocalyptic, like decayed kingdom. Everything is kind of in ruins. There aren't a lot of people around or bugs. There aren't a lot of other bugs around. The bugs that you meet, there's something wrong with them.
Okay.
They're villainous, maybe, or maybe they're just misunderstood and you're murdering them. I feel like there's going to be some kind of a morally gray thing happening, but it just feels lonely and kind of, I don't know, low magic, low jinx. It's good, man. I think you guys would like it a lot. The music is really evocative.
And the backgrounds are really beautiful.
Really
like the whole,
pretty.
The whole, that's what I remember, like standouts from it. Like it's very picturesque, sort of like backgrounds behind the side scroller kind of layout, right?
Yeah, and I'm not sure if they're hand drawn or not, but everything moves really well and scales really well, and it's just a really cool game. I think you guys would dig it.
Cool.
So next time it's on sale on Steam, pick it up. And it's a fun way to play it because you could play it on the TV, and it scales up well and it scales down well if you want to play it handheld.
Right. Oh, nice.
It works really well both ways. And I've found some games really kind of don't look so good on the TV, but this one looks great and sounds great both ways.
Sweet.
Cool. Yep. Well, that's my one thing.
Nice. Okay. So I'll take us home. I'll be real quick. So I guess my one thing over the past little while has been... it's the Billy bookshelf series by IKEA, because I recently made a trip to the IKEA with Liz, and specifically we were on the hunt for some more bookshelves. We knew before the holidays that was something that I wanted to try to do to kind of expand, because I had paperbacks that were double stacked across some shelves, and we needed to get some more bookshelves, and got them, and thankfully, because heads up, if you've not been to IKEA since before COVID, which we hadn't, a lot of this stuff's not necessarily in stock. It seems like the model they're moving towards now is that they've got everything on the showroom, so you kind of see what you want, but of course you buy things online and then you can get it delivered to the house, that kind of thing, which is fine, but shipping was expensive, so we've held off on that, and we were just sort of rolled the dice. And luckily I was able to get the bookshelves that I wanted and I needed. And I'm stoked.
They look good.
I love them. They're not necessarily the fanciest of the fancy, but I'm not a wealthy man. So if you're wanting to buy a bunch of bookshelves, you know, and the way I've got them in my place, they kind of wrap around the corner of a room, right? That kind of thing. So you can get a lot of shelf space for relatively modest, on the order of a few hundred to, you know, $300 or $400 for like a big bookshelf. Anyway,
they're stout.
The IKEA Billies, yeah, and they're legit. They're not like cheapos that are just gonna like bend and break. Like yeah. I've had my current setup double stacked with some paperbacks for about the past year. Not all the way through, but there's never once been a bow, and I've had a lot of weight in those things. So I'm excited, and I've got them bolted like into the wall, that kind of thing. And otherwise, the Calyx, that is the Cadillac of like vinyl or board game storage too, because that design is even tougher. You don't get quite so much real estate for actual storage, but they look cool and they're legit. So anyway, I guess IKEA modular shelf storage is my thing, but specifically the Billy bookcases are my thing because I built them and I'm in the process of trying to reorganize my Shiznit.
That's how you know you're listening to a bibliophile podcast. Yeah. When we have like specific series of bookshelves that we're like, no, that's the one.
That's the bookshelf for the two-fisted son of a plumber. Just a working man. He's got a bunch of paperbacks, baby.
That's right.
How many Swedish meatballs could you eat on a trip to IKEA? You're hungry.
Oh.
You're hungry. You've been through the showroom a number of times.
I've never had an IKEA meatball, so I can't speak to this.
I mean, I would say I could probably eat 10 or a dozen. Yeah. But this time around, didn't eat any because we got there when they opened and we hit the restaurant or hit that midway point. And Liz was like, I'm not really hungry. I'm like, let's push. Because I was wanting to, I was eager to see if they had the bookcases and stuff. So rather than the Swedish meatballs, I had a Baconator from Wendy's.
You skipped the Oasis that is the IKEA.
I went straight
food court.
To the 1,000-calorie, like, double meat and baconator.
The most American thing.
Oh my God. It was trash. But the Westchester, Ohio IKEA, they've got like crappy Applebee's type restaurants, right? You know, they've got a lot of that. But that doesn't do any good if you got stuff in the back of the truck.
Right.
Right. That does you no good. Or they have McDonald's, Wendy's, and Hardee's. I wasn't expecting Taco Bell. Like that's kind of like truck stop or like right. college food, but I would rather have had Taco Bell. But there was nothing else. And you give me those options and it's just a coin toss. Yeah. I don't care. Just give me like some trash cheeseburger.
That's prime real estate for a Gold Star.
That's
chili.
Exactly yeah. right. No, yeah. no, it absolutely is.
Or
but
five,
again,
five, what's the name?
No, it's Gold Star.
Gold Star, okay.
Gold Star or Skyline. Star.
Skyline,
yeah.
that's
yeah, those
five
are the
guys,
two the
five
two
stars.
Big.
Five Guys chili.
But like anything else, just give me like a Subway sandwich or give me some like chicken. I would have been on that in a minute, but I had a Baconator. I wasn't necessarily sad because I was slamming again, like straight up a meat sandwich. And that like fueled my ride home for the next 2 hours, beating the rain, getting home with my bookshelves and all that. But anyway, that's our one things. Sorry for bookshelf sidetrack. But
sorry for meatball sidetrack. Really, the book, it was my fault.
Mix them all together, put them in a pot, call it
one day.
I gotta say, the banter after 10 years, top notch.
Top notch. Yeah. It only gets better.
Top shelf, number 46.
Not even anywhere close to my maximum potential. I'm like Goku.
Your bantometer?
Yeah.
Is it like an 88?
It's 9,000.
Oh. you're of 10,000 maximum?
No.
There's no
unlimited.
Max?
No, there's no max.
All right. Well, those things out of the way. Let's talk about this dude named Conan.
Conan the Barbarian.
Conan the King.
Conan the King.
The King.
Of Aquilonia.
The poets and the people of the city don't necessarily feel that he's their king, though.
Man, this Robert E. Howard, he sure does not like poets or poetry. That's one thing I can take from this story. That was one of my – maybe we'll start with that, actually, as a little segue.
Okay.
Like, of my talking points, what did I say here? I said we're all reading of the Del Rey. So on page 26, it says – no good can come of poets, right? And previous to that in the introduction, so there's a couple of references to Rinaldo and how poets are kind of just this miscreants and kind of renegades and like political dissidents. And it's funny how Howard goes to such pains to paint poets as part of civilization. When we just spent a whole season on poetry and a large focus on Howard. And the story is, of course, littered with Howard's poetry.
Right.
It just cracks me up.
But he also kind of sings their praises. A great poet is greater than any king. His songs are mightier than my scepter, for he has near ripped my heart from my breast when he has chose to sing for me, says Conan.
So he's a man of two minds, right?
Yeah. Conan likes the poet. Like he even doesn't want to kill him.
Right. No, you're end. Right. He yeah. does. Yeah. Well,
he's afraid, I think, that he'll martyr him, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
that'll make it worse.
It will make it worse.
Yeah. But he also likes his poetry.
I think he likes to listen to him.
Yeah.
This and is the also, guy that's I do think that he doesn't think that Ronaldo is, like, worthy of actual warfare.
Right.
There's a bit of that. It's like, oh, fancy pants, I'm not going to, like, swing my sword or my axe at you. I don't want to kill you. I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
And then he does.
Sure does.
But, you know, so what was the other line? Maybe we can return to this. I'll go ahead and say mine. As far as like your favorite lines of the story, okay. I think that might be another fun thing for us to do across stories. But I think probably my favorite line from the story, and you can probably guess this, but Ronaldo wrote a deathly song there, and Keen was the stylist.
Yes.
Whenever everybody's like coming back to King Conan at the end and kind of like stitching him up and taking care of him, that's such a good turn of phrase, and it's so much better than. It's kind of the same sentiment in the Cole story by This Axe I Rule, but this is just a little bit more poetic. The fact that he uses the Keen stylus as the symbol for the dagger.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
So he has this love for Ronaldo, but
he's got a soft spot for
him. I think it's funny that he's like Howard just wants to be salty on poets. It's the pot calling the kettle black.
Now you got me thinking about what is my favorite line from this story.
That's what I'm thinking about too.
Yeah.
There's some choice ones.
There's great scenes. There's great lines.
Yeah.
The whole way through.
Yeah. If you let me do a scene, it would probably be the scene where Thothamon, the key wizard and deuteragonist of the story, perhaps, he's trying to call that demon forth to do his bidding. And he has a sock or a sandal to give him. Like, to me, that is so cold-blooded. Like, he's holding on to this dude's shoe just in case he ever gets a demon to do his thing.
It's vindictive,
man. It's super vindictive. Like, that's good Thothamon characterization by the guy that created him.
this whole thing, like, Thothamon is only in this for the first four, like, chapters, right?
Yep.
And of those, he's only truly in it in two of them. Or maybe the first three, even.
Yeah.
He's there with Escalante. And the beginning of it,
right?
We find out he's a slave. We find out he used to be a wizard of some status and some
renown.
Yeah, some renown. We know that there are people in Stygia who would love to kill him. Like a wind will blow up from the south, and then who will protect you, Thothamon?
Yep.
Like that is pretty badass.
Yes.
And then we learn that he's lost his magic ring, and with it, he could wield the magics of the dark. And this fool Dion somehow has it.
Yeah.
I love it. I love the
ring. He's just this Dumbo, fat
drunk duke,
fat baron. Yeah,
baron.
That's my ring. Yeah. He's not even listening to Thothamon talk to him
because he's like, a slave.
Yes.
Yeah. Like he doesn't listen to people who are beneath him. He doesn't realize he's holding court with the greatest wizard that Stygia ever set forth.
Yeah. What's more, he wants to be the king, right? Dion wants to be the king,
right.
He thinks that he's pulling all the strings when Escalante is pulling some strings, and then Thothamon pulls some string. There's a lot of double and triple and quadruple crosses in this.
Yeah, I like that there's kind of maybe two tiers of villains. There's the way I wrote them was the Rebel Four. There's like the four cogs in the machine that are doing things.
Dion and Grommel and Ronaldo.
The Rebel Four.
Those dudes. Yeah.
And then there's Escalante and Thothamon.
Yeah.
And they're kind of like the next level. And you don't quite know what the hierarchy there is. Because at least at first, Escalante is like, slave, listen to me. And then Thothamon, of course, travels to the nether void of the Shadow Walker or whatever. And does his bidding and calls forth a demonic baboon. It's hard to tell who the ultimate arch-villain is. I guess it's Escalante, and I guess Thothamon is just a cool, like, spooky side villain for the sequel, right? Or for another a story for another day. Mm-hmm. But it's cool that there's multiple antagonists that are all – they all have their own motivations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the way to say it.
And the like, we never meet – who's the former king? Numidides?
Numidides, yeah.
We never meet him, but the ghost of him hangs over the story somewhat because Ronaldo has conjured him and sort of
– they burn incense to his statue. They pray to him.
Yeah, he's sort of canonized him in terms of the populace's memory.
Yep, right.
This tyrant that the same people that languished in his dungeons now pray to him for release from Conan's rule.
We don't really know what he was doing, right? Like, we don't know why he was such a bad dude. But
civilization shit, right?
Civilization stuff. Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. Like, I should never have questioned that.
That's what Howard would say. Like, this is a guy that was a full government goon. Like, he probably had hundreds of people locked up for nothing.
For nothing.
I mean, collecting taxes out the wazoo.
Yeah.
Probably didn't earn any of it, and earn his keep, earn his place.
He was born to it.
Yeah.
Kind of like Dion. Yeah. I guess.
So, right. It to me, Nemedides came off as very much the, like, fat, corrupt king. The king, King John? Who's the...
Oh, yeah. From Robin Hood. Yeah, he's a lion.
That kind of thing.
It was King John ruling instead of King Richard.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Prince John.
There we go. Yeah, yes. King Richard the Lionheart is out crusading, and Prince John is...
Right, mucking it up on the throne.
Yeah, with a snake.
Well...
Stop hissing in my ear! Yeah, another snake. Yeah.
Another snake.
Holy crap. It's like a ring.
It is.
It just keeps...
An Ouroboros.
Coiling on itself.
It feeds upon itself.
It's so good. I still love Thothamon as this horrible arch-villain for Conan, and it is a bummer that we never see him again in another Howard story. It's cool. Like, I read through all of the Dark Horse Conans, you know, a year or so ago, and it was cool to see what they had done to make Thothamon Conan's prime villain, and he keeps dropping in and messing things up, and... Conan never really gets the better of him. It's cool.
It is.
I wanted to talk about the Sumeria poem and Conan, the first time we see him, Conan drawing a map. I remember this being something that we talked about 10 years ago.
Right.
This was striking to me then, and it's striking to me now. And I think that it's more striking to me now knowing what I know about Robert E. Howard. Mm-hmm. So Howard's a history guy, right? Howard's a history guy, and he loves to wax on about different civilizations and what they're like and where they were. And
Likes maps.
Yeah. And that's what Conan's doing. He's drawing a map, and he's talking to his pal. Is it Prospero?
Yep, mm-hmm. Prospero.
About all these different countries that are north of Sumeria and countries that most people in the south would think are mythological.
Mythic.
I love that. I love that. This figure walks this line between what is real and what is fantastical to the minds of those around him. But when we talk about Sumeria, when Conan talks about Sumeria, it's a gloomy place. People worship Crom. When they die, they go to his foggy hell, basically.
It sucks here and it sucks there.
Yeah. And I had to get out. And every time I think about it, I'd need some wine, basically. And I wonder about that as a coping mechanism. If this is... lots of people will point to Conan being kind of a wish fulfillment thing for Howard. And I don't necessarily think it's a wish fulfillment thing. I think Conan is maybe an idealized version of Howard, Conan exists as a barbaric character from a barbaric place, but he does not succumb to the worst of barbarism. So, like, when we read these other Howard stories, I'm thinking mainly like the Bran McMorn stories. The Picts like are the opposite end of this spectrum between civilization and barbarism, right? And
yeah, there's like feral.
And there's like a green zone somewhere in the middle where you can exist, if you can exist, because it's hard, because you're going to be fighting civilization, which won't understand you, and the barbarians, which won't understand you. So you're kind of this loner. You're kind of this anomaly, right?
You're really fit within.
Yeah, you don't really fit.
I would posit for something to us to like come back to that is a bit of Howard saying that's what it means to be like a fully realized person.
Okay.
With the statement of I was a man before I was a king. Like, to be a man is to occupy that green zone that you're talking about in between the C versus B, as I kind of like shorthand it in my notes, like that civilization versus barbarism. There's that sweet spot. That's truly what it means, because erring on either side sort of deviates from a true sort of moral compass and a good way of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Either side corrupts your moral compass, right? Yeah. Like you lose true north and you can't navigate anymore because you're corrupted either by the barbaric forces around you or the quote civilized forces around you. Mm-hmm. I love that.
It's so funny because I found myself thinking as I was reading, what did we talk about before? What's standing out now versus then? There's a statement that Escalante offers before we get the quote of, you know, I was a man before I was a king, right? Before that little like quote from the Road of Kings comes up, that Escalante says, I was a statesman before I was an outlaw.
Oh, yeah.
He mentions that like within the first sort of bit of the story.
I was a wizard before I was a slave.
It's a these statements of sort of following that framework. But I think it's very telling, like with the I was a man before I was a king is a statement of like the moral center of Conan. And on the side of the civilization corrupts with Escalante, because I think that's what he is. I was a statesman before I was an outlaw. It's kind of like those are kind of two sides of the coin. It's very reminiscent, actually, of our Tanith Lee discussions with the companions on the road, like mm-hmm. with the first story. Mm-hmm. That it's, you know, there's those various characters that are all riding together, and there's a lot of this civilization being the corrupt kind of faction or facet of
right.
of the story there. I mean, it's such a recurrent kind of thing, but I think it's apt. Like, it's cool that Howard has this very simple, it's not like an axiom, right? It's more of a, like, it's like a little, it's not a motto. Like, what would be the right term for like that kind of pithy statement?
A mantra?
Like maybe.
Yeah, I'm struggling too.
Yeah, like the framework, that little narrative device of having this simple statement of I was this before that and having it as this recurrent element in the story and being an important sort of philosophical statement. It's very clever. It's I know we're going to get to John's external scholarship readings that he did. it is expert writing. That's all I wanted to sort of wrap it up with there.
And I did not think about the I was a wizard before I was a slave and I was an outlaw before I was like that stood out to me this time through, but it didn't dawn on me that it was related to I was a man before I was a king. But you're right. Each of these guys are kind of occupying this civilization barbarism axis, and they start and end on different places. Are they all in the green zone, you think?
No, I think that Escalante is erring too far on the seaside, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about Thoth, old Thothy. It's funny. At one point, he's referred to simply as Thoth, mm-hmm. maybe a time or two. Right. So Thoth is his first name. it's his Christian name. It's his given name or whatever.
His satanic name.
His satanic name. His Setian name.
Yeah.
Old Thoth. I don't know where he kind of shakes out because I think he is a more admirable character. I mean, he's delving into some dark business. Yeah. As compared to Escalante, like those are the two big bads. He is the better of the two big bads. He is the sympathetic antagonist. Mm-hmm. Escalante is just the butthole that you want to see die.
Right.
But Thoth, I want to see like get his righteous revenge and maybe live happily ever after. I would be okay with that at this point.
I think he is an interesting character to compare to the C versus the B, the barbarism versus civilization, because he and his culture, by like nature of this conversation that we have in this story of Mitras versus Set,
yeah,
are almost opposed to either of the civilizations or barbarisms that occur in this part of the world. Like, you almost can't put him into their moral universe because they live in a different one.
So Set in this world, in the Hyborian Age, is obviously a god of darkness, of deceit, magic, like sorcery here we're learning is no good. Right.
Right. No bueno. It is truly sword and sorcery, magic equals bad yeah. stuff.
It takes blood. It takes evil, dark rings.
Well, unless you're Epimetrius.
Right. Who is fueled by the Phoenix of right. God.
The Phoenix of God.
Yeah.
Of Gad.
But regardless, like, lurking in the background are nameless old ones, right?
That is
like,
true. Yeah. Like, it's not a nice place, the Epimetrius' tomb. It's not right. somewhere you would really want to take someone on a first date.
Not the Rock of Eternity.
You know, yeah. Conan has this dream, and there's this HPL reference, and looming in the background are these nameless old ones. There's misty moors, seemingly, and that's
the steps
land.
Are snakeheads, so that you're constantly stepping on set as you descend down to talk to Epimetrius. This is my favorite part of the whole story, the Epimetrius tangent where he goes into a dream world and meets this old wizard that's been dead for 1500 years but lived probably 300 years, sort of like a Moses analog type
guy.
Definitely tapped into Jehovah or Yahweh or whatever you want to call him, which is the Phoenix, which is Mithras, and then Set, the devil. I mean, if you want to put these in like Christian theology terms,
sure.
Who's like wrapped around the world at one point, a bit of Norse mythology, like the Jormungandr serpent.
Yeah, yeah.
All that kind of stuff. All very ancient stuff, right? We play the snakes against us constantly. I think it's interesting to think about how many people have mined like the modern, we've talked about this before, the reptilian conspiracies that were born out of some of Howard's work on accident.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you start to see some of that being born here in this story.
I didn't get the chance to read it this time around. I know it'll come up, but I've got one of the older Darkman issues. And there's a Jeff Shanks article about theosophy, mm-hmm. like in the Hyborian Age, that kind of thing. And I'm going to read through that. But, Thoth pops up, of course, but also Thune pops up in the story. And these are like common terms that have been adapted in like contemporary sword and sorcery. Like I was thinking about Skylar Hernstrom's Thune's Vision, his first like collection. He's got this story called Thune's Vision. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, I know Thune. But then I got to thinking about it. Oh, well, Thoth is like the Book of Thoth. And we've got Aleister Crowley and the sort of like the tarot deck. And there's all of these recurrent names that just sort of pop up, and it's a well. Like yeah. at this point, Howard is clearly tapping into some theosophic stuff that feeds into serpent alien right. conspiracy.
Yeah, we deal with that today. I have the abridged Helena Blavatsky book if you ever want to borrow it.
I would yeah. love that. Yeah. Maybe we'll just return to the Lost World season.
I would love to have more theosophic discussion. I think it's very interesting. He clearly read something about yeah. it right at the time. He wasn't getting it off Wikipedia or anything, obviously, but I really dig this idea of Conan being called forth as the representation of the light, even though he is the barbarous.
And he's resistant to it, right?
He is resistant.
He hates the religion.
Yeah, yeah. He doesn't believe in Mithras, really, right? No. Like, this isn't his jam, but he is still going to get branded. And all of it it's just very cool. I don't want to necessarily leave it at that, but this whole Christian thing playing out here where he's going to get the symbol, be empowered by a religion he doesn't necessarily believe in, and use it to fight demons. I mean, where can you go wrong with that?
It's a little bit Christian, and it's a whole lot like anti-hero. Like, you like to see him as the reluctant leader, and you like to see him as the reluctant protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love it. Like, one of my other favorite lines is when he lashes out at the priest, mm-hmm. when he's like, hold your tongue, dude. Right. at the end. You just want to see him like slap that priest.
You do, a little bit.
Mm-hmm. He's like, I don't.
And part of that is because I think that would have conveyed more of how not full power Mithras is. Like, the sword still breaks when it goes off of a man's helmet, which is sort of like the weak sorcery part of sword and sorcery.
Right.
But it does kill a demon. So it's just all very interesting. I can see why this caught on with people.
And I like that because it didn't turn the sword into like the master sword from Zelda, right?
It's
like,
not Excalibur.
It's not a power up. Yeah. It's just an ability that it's been imbued with.
Right.
Yet here in the first or one of the first sword and sorcery stories, we see a magic item b- be bestowed upon our hero.
Yep.
Just for the record.
Just for the record.
Magic items, one.
Right.
Two. And really two because of Thoth's ring. Yeah. I wanted to see what you guys thought about Patrice. So Patrice Lunet writes in the Hyborian Genesis essay about Howard taking names from Bullfinch's mythology and sort of changing them for his own ends and using them as inspiration. So page 437, that's in the Hyborian Genesis essay in the Del Rey. It talks about Hyboria and Aquilonia and King Numa, Epimetrius potentially being a reference to Prometheus, Stygia and Thoth Amon. I've been thinking about Thoth Amon a lot. And it says the Egyptians acknowledged as the highest deity Amun, afterwards called Zeus or Jupiter Amon. The word Thoth doesn't appear in Bullfinch. So I don't know about Thoth. It's kind of a Crowley-esque thing, right? That maybe Howard ran across at some point.
Yeah.
But no, impossible, right? So I don't know. I don't know Thoth, but Amon must mean like of the highest order. So he's like mega Thoth.
Mega Thoth. Maybe Thoth means wizard.
Maybe.
Magic user.
In one of the Dark Horse comics, Thoth is his name and he kills his friend Amon as a sacrifice to gain magics and takes his name as in remembrance of his friend that paved the path to his power. So he becomes Thoth Amon.
So the Book of Thoth, according to the Wikipedia, was featured in Sax Rohmer's Brood of the Witch Queen in 1918. And was also mentioned in several stories by Lovecraft, most notably Through the Gates of the Silver Key.
There we go.
So So given that there's the Lovecraft references here, that's probably where it came from. Because I was curious about Crowley and the kind of, Through the Gates of the Silver Key was actually written between 32 and 33. So this came out before that.
Hmm.
So there had to be some sort of reference ahead of that.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the Sax Rohmer thing. I mean, Sax Rohmer seems to be one of the authors that Howard would have really dug, right? And taken some inspiration from.
For sure.
Like, look at Skullface. I don't know if you guys have read that story yet or not on your own, but it's very much a detective versus an Eastern threat kind of thing.
And of course, the Book of Thoth and the stuff by Aleister Crowley came out after Howard died. Like the 40s, 50s. Yeah. So there's that theosophic reference point that everybody was drawn from.
Mm-hmm.
Question marks. This is cool. Maybe. I'm loving that we're like, I don't think we talked about this way back when. Maybe we got into it in the Lost World season, but maybe.
I think Theosophy came up much more with Lemuria.
We had a Blavatsky kind of focus with some of that. Something was in Howard's head, though, that clued him into this stuff.
What else, John?
What else, Josh? I like the two paths that we're taking. You were talking about how Thoth Amon doesn't even appear in the entire tale and he doesn't show up in the final battle or anything. Yeah. But I like how it's that meme, the two cars driving by each other.
Right.
You see him and Conan, Conan doesn't want the magic stuff. Thoth does. And they're not really they're going to cross paths, but they're not going to run headfirst into each other in this story. By the end of this, you're really kind of craving a sequel where Conan and Thoth have some sort of showdown over Aquilonia, over power, as it over is generally over something. Like they clearly are two ships passing in the night, and they're both imbued with great destiny, seemingly of evil and good.
But Thoth doesn't give two craps about King Conan or who's the king in Aquilonia, right? Like he doesn't care.
But he might care if it got him power to go back to Stygia.
Maybe sure,
yeah.
He cares if Dion is going to become the king, then he wants to be Dion's dude.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he's spilling the beans about Ascalante, but Dion mucks everything up.
Yeah.
But Thoth says, to the demon, hey, here's the slipper that I stole. This is the scent. Kill him. I and anyone with him.
Right.
And that's what gets this demon set against Conan. Like, it's right. an accident. Right. He's not trying to kill Conan. He wants revenge.
It's the scent of circumstance.
Yeah.
He just happens to be the dude that's there adjacent mm-hmm. to Ascalante.
Very adjacent.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
So I love that idea that, you know, it's not as though this demon has come to assassinate the king at all.
Yeah. Right. It's all happenstance.
It's yeah. one more, like, crazy messed up story in the broad, long history of Conan the Barbarian. Like, oh my God, let me tell you stories about my life. There was this one time that the demon baboon almost wrecked me. I happened to be king.
Right.
But just by circumstance, I had to fight this devil monkey
who also stopped me from getting usurped.
Yeah,
basically
I was almost assassinated. Right. I had to slay like 20 bros, and then devil monkey showed up
with a decorative battle axe. Like, he's got mall ninja stuff that he rips off the wall.
Yeah, mall ninja. Yes. And Epimetheus must sense that Conan needs to live. Right
Yeah, like, he's destined.
So that notion that you are a great man that is destined to do something great and you have to survive whatever this thing is that's about to happen to you, that I'm not going to tell you really what it is, but here's a magic sword. And that'll help. Now, go. Run along, Junior. That runs counter to a lot of sword and sorcery definitions, right?
Fair.
Like, that kind of crosses, I think, into a very fairy tale or a Tolkien-esque.
A chosen one.
Yeah.
So it's this occurred to me too as I was reading through it. I can't remember who coined the term, but I was thinking about like Dan Carlin hardcore history episodes. Oh. And he consistently refers to like the great man theory of history. Yeah. This very much is Conan as a great man of history. He's clearly destined. The stars are aligned. Dude doesn't want to abide by the stars, doesn't know what the stars are telling him, but the stars are still portending this thing that he's going to do. And he's got to be along for the ride.
And this is peak era of that sort of thinking for Napoleon.
Yep.
and Alexander the Great and everything. So absolutely would have leaked into a history buff like Howard.
Mm.
But it's very different than what we think about sword and sorcery meaning. Like, we think about Fawford and Mouser being like two bros just up for whatever, and they just fall into whatever misadventures. I don't know if they're ever destined for anything. I don't know if that's ever portended with what we've read so far or what I've read.
I don't think so. I mean, there are stories where, you know, their wizard friends Ningobble and I can't remember the other one.
Oh man. Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah.
Shelob. Yeah. It's not Shelob. That's Tolkien.
they kind of hint that they need them to do something big for them.
Yeah, someday. Like, but they're like pawns on the chessboard.
Yeah.
And this is more like Epimetheus is rescuing the hero.
Mm-hmm.
It's different.
I might push different. Back against that a little bit, because okay. I don't think he's necessarily trying to save Conan. He has to save Conan to save Aquilonia and to save like Western Europe, basically,
okay,
from Stygian, Setian forces. Like, he even says, your destiny is one with Aquilonia. Gigantic happenings are forming in the web and the womb of fate, and a blood-mad sorcerer shall not stand in the path of imperial destiny. Oh. Ages ago, Set coiled about the world like a python about its prey. All my life, which was as the lives of three common men, I fought him. I drove him into the shadows of the mysterious south, but in dark Stygia, men still worship him, who to us is the archdemon. As I fought Set, I fight his worshipers and his votaries and his acolytes. Hold out your sword. You are my weapon.
So, okay. I rescind my argument, because that very much does sound like Conan is simply a pawn within.
He's like a rook.
Yes. Or, yeah.
He's pretty strong.
But that's still along the lines of of Fofford and Mouser playing on the table that's being set before them. So that makes sense.
It's interesting that the parallel between Conan and Aqualonia is being drawn there, given that Aqualonia is like the shining gem of civilization, right?
Right.
In the Numidian Chronicles that we get, and Conan is not that. That's pretty cool. It takes a man like Conan.
It takes a barbarian.
Right. And so I still think the great man theory, if you look at it from a certain point of view, yes, like Obi-Wan would, it still works. I think it still works.
Yeah.
I mean, he would.
It's not like he chose Escalante. It's not like he chose Dion.
He will, to history, be a great man. But to Epimetrius, I don't think he is.
Yeah, no, he's a flunky, yeah, right? Like, you're just a big, strong chunk of beef, and I'm going to send you out there and hope that you
get to stabbing, son.
Yeah, get to stabbing with this.
It's dangerous to go alone.
Yes.
As you said earlier.
Right.
I really like this story. I know that when we were talking beforehand, there was some talk about how it's not, you mentioned Patrice's essay. It's not really the first Conan story. It's the first published Conan story.
Right.
Some cool Patrice stuff that you talked about.
Cool Patrice stuff. So Patrice Lunet says in the Hyborian Genesis that Conan is mentioned in a prior story called People of the Dark. And this is a sort of a genetic memory reincarnation kind of story where some modern day guys are in a cave and they pass out or they fall and knock themselves out. And then suddenly they're back in the Hyborian age, maybe, and there's a guy, and his name is Conan, and he's a reaver, and he's a barbarian, and he's dark and sullen, and this and that. And that might be the first mention of Conan, but that's not Conan as we know him.
Right.
We take that, and we blend it with the poem Sumeria that starts with two words. Do you remember what they are?
I remember.
Memory again, right? Like, this is somebody remembering a place in an ancient time that is a gloomy spot that, you know, they're not super happy about having in their history. And then we come to Conan when he talks about King Conan, when he talks about Sumeria, it's very much that, right? And so Patrice is kind of putting all of this together into a mesh where he's saying, look, these pieces that ultimately become the story of the Phoenix on the Sword were kicking around in Howard's mind long before the revision of By the Saxi Rule that ultimately becomes the Phoenix on the Sword.
Yeah.
And I think that's really cool that this notion of all of these exterior sort of forces leading Howard to write the story or at least inspiring him to write the story. Very interesting to me. And then you mentioned, John, that you had found some scholarship by friend of the show,
Bobby Derry.
I'm trying to think of like a Lovecraftian acolyte,
yeah,
dark wizard, Bobby Derry.
Yep.
And what'd he say?
Oh, I was waiting for more adjectives.
I can't think of like the superlative.
Yeah. Badass Bobby Derry.
The superlative, like Bobby Derry.
Yep. The BABD.
He has an article on Blackgate, Hither Came Conan by Bobby Derry, The Phoenix on the Sword. We'll link to it in the show notes, of course. It talks about some of the same things that Patrice says, probably even cites Patrice's article. He argues that the story behind the Phoenix on the Sword is almost as interesting the tale itself. It's the first adventure of Conan the Sumerian, but that is just part of it. Howard sold the story to Farnsworth Wright in 1924 in Weird Tales, and sold his first story in 1924.
Yeah, Spear and Fang. Right?
And then in 1932 Conan. I'm kind of paraphrasing here.
You're good.
But basically, I think this is the counter argument that even Howard would offer up, which is, Howard wrote, quote, to Clark Ashton Smith that Conan, quote, suddenly seemed to grow in my mind without much labor on my part, and immediately a stream of stories flowed off my pen. But Bobby Derry argues, and I think what we're trying to highlight here, is that this isn't just a stroke of luck. As Epimetrius would say, like, there's a destiny for this character and there's a reason.
Absolutely.
It's a well-crafted character. And Bobby's quote that I think is really, really cool and evocative of kind of what we're trying to get here. The Phoenix on the Sword is not the surprise effort of an uneducated prodigy. It is the masterpiece of a journeyman that has served their time honing his craft and now, after 7 years apprenticeship, showcases their skills. Basically pointing out that he portrays himself as a spontaneous writer, but the stories represent real research on the Texan's part, mm-hmm. and the first rough gems always had to be polished by subsequent passes.
Man,
nice.
Absolutely. So I skimmed through my Lancer version of By This Axe I Rule, and I know we talked about that story way back when. I had forgotten that there's kind of like this this love interest, like, couple sort of situation that's the machination. They can't get hitched, and King Cole has to remedy the situation, and there's this plan to, like, upset the throne and assassinations. Phoenix on the Sword is a far better story. That mm-hmm. is my read 1,000 times over. And we probably said that way back when, but this is a revised story, all the more tighter and all the better. Like mm-hmm. the character aside, and whether this is the first or the last time that we would ever see Conan, this story is badass. Like, mm-hmm. like it works. It's functional in and of itself. It's really pretty stellar on that front.
It's real good. It's one of my favorites, and it's the first one, right? Like, it's one of my favorite Conans, and it's one of the...
Yeah, I know that people always talk about, like, what's your favorite Conan story, and what would you put in a collection of Conan stories? You would be a dum-dum if you didn't start with this story. That's I don't know if that's a hot take. That's just a take. Like, what better way than to start with this because of such expert world building? This is the other thing that I guess that I had scribbled down, is that it is very picture perfect. Like, there's very clever and appropriate information dumps about the world, the mm-hmm. gods, the setting. You get a map. You don't have to see a map, because Conan tells you about the map mm-hmm. of what is to the north of Samaria and to the northwest of Samaria, and where Acolonia and Stygia and all these various lands are in relation, and who their gods are. It is deftly done, and it's an excellent introduction to Conan the Sumerian. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so great that it starts with this.
And that structure that we like so much is largely due to Farnsworth Wright, who I think is an unsung hero in terms of getting this story published. Maybe also a villain. We'll talk about it in a second. I have two things, and I know we're running a little late.
We're good.
But the first one I want to say, Farnsworth looked at the draft of Phoenix on the Sword that Howard sent him, sent it back, said, we're going to accept this, but you need to edit down chapter 2, because chapter 2 is kind of boring, and maybe chapter 1 and 2, he spends too much time building the world in very dry kind of historian ways in those two chapters. And so Howard gets it back, and then he adds this prologue, this Nemedian Chronicles, that is, I think, some of the best Howard writing. Know, O Prince, that in the years between when the oceans drink Atlantis and the rise of the sons of Arius, there was an age undreamed of. And then he goes and tells you all the major players in the Hyborian Age and where they are and what they do and how they're linked to one another. But the greatest of them all is Aquilonia. And that is a tiny, tidy little paragraph that does way more, like, it lifts way above its weight class.
For sure.
Kudos, man. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
And the Nemedian Chronicles obviously inspired people, because I think people were writing in asking to read it.
Yeah.
And Howard had to be like, I don't have it.
Ain't no such thing.
Ain't no such thing. It's part of a story. Because his poems are so clearly evocative and written that, like, people are like, oh, I want the rest of this.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So love that.
Yes.
So thanks, Farnsworth. The next part, here, Farnsworth is a villain. Because the next two stories that Howard writes about Conan, he writes them in rapid succession. The next one is The Frost Giant's Daughter.
Right.
And it's a very mythological take. Conan is a younger man. It's a very Greek myth kind of, Apollonian and...
Dionysian.
Well, not Dionysius, right? Apollo is madly in lust and is chasing maybe Aphrodite or something.
Right.
Like, you're so this is a restructuring of that myth.
Yep.
And the rape of Persephone.
Maybe.
Is that it?
No, he's...
I don't think so. I think there's a...
I've seen the statue. I wish I could remember.
Where Apollo is like driven mad in lust by Aphrodite and is trying to get her. But I could be totally wrong. So listeners, please correct me. I've had a little maker's mark here. But that is the next one that he writes. Farnsworth rejects it. The third one that he writes, The God in the Bowl, does not get accepted by Weird Tales either. Mm-hmm. So... you could see very quickly Howard becoming maybe kind of discouraged about Conan, and he does not. He keeps writing Conan. So Farnsworth here is rejecting a lot of Howard's subsequent Conan efforts. He keeps on doing it. He keeps on writing Conan until ultimately we get The Scarlet Citadel, which is a kind of a follow-up to this in a way. So those are the two things that I cannot stress the importance of Farnsworth Wright in terms of Howard's life and maybe even his death.
Whoa.
Can't stress the importance enough.
Okay. That's the role of the editor, right? To be the hero and the villain.
I guess so. Yeah.
Have we covered all the bases?
I think that was everything that I had.
Have we slayed the demon?
Looking at my notes here.
I think so. Do you guys have any other top quotes, top bits to mention?
I don't think so. I love that at the end they're like, you know, the king is unwell and he's like, look at the thing on the floor, and it's like melted into the floor, like there's an imprint left of it, and they're all just kind of looking at it, and then the curtain falls.
I like it.
I think this is the story that we have talked about the most on the show.
Probably. We always come back to the, how do you first see Conan? He's he's the man with the map.
But our very first episode, Phoenix on the Sword. Rota Revisions, we had Karen Joan Kahodic on to talk about Phoenix on the Sword and By the Saxar Rule. Now we're back to the Phoenix on the Sword. That's three episodes devoted to the Phoenix on the Sword. This is an important story.
So like for Howard of content,
yeah. For Howard studies, like you, I think this is a pivotal moment. This is a pivotal story in Howard's career.
Yeah,
and it gives us a character that is older than Superman and Batman, and just as enduring.
Yep.
And of course, it's cool. He was writing what Solomon Kane and other characters before this, but this is the moneymaker. This is the big Kahuna, but it took some craft and some journeyman's effort, as Derry said, to get to it. And this kind of like opens things up. Yeah. Other stuff you wanted to mention, John?
Oh, you asked about cool quotes. I just was going to do the who dies first when he's kind of battered up against the wall and it looks like he's done. I mean, that's a cool movie action movie quote. Standing there with a broken sword and a broken axe, half cleaved.
Yeah, super badass.
Very Conan. Like all of the Conan elements are here. He's older, and it's cool that we get him younger later. But yeah, we've built the personality, we've built the profile, and we get to see it applied to all these different occupations.
Yep.
And it's just so much fun. It's not an amazing wonder that this turned into the big Kahuna for Howard.
He's so badass. Like the postures, I love the he's on the brink of death. Everybody's like, sew him up, medic. Right. And he's like, bring me wine. And, you know, he's like slaying his thirsty work. That's the best, right? Yeah, like, there's such like cool stuff like that. The other line that really stood out to me this time was Prospero, when we first meet Conan, who's studying his maps and he's like giving his little bits. And Prospero tells Conan it's all part of the game. It's very much of The Wire, and we got Omar coming, and all he's like, it's all in the game. And in This Axe I Rule, it's by This Axe I Rule, it's Brühl says a similar thing to Cole, only it's not quite so elegant. But it's Omar. It's all in the game. And it's so crazy that this was written so far back, that there's this recognition of civilization and barbarism in this kind of like game of chess, and that, I don't know, it's beautiful. It's so beautiful. So Anyway, that's that just sort of tweaked my antennas for The Wire. That's something that stood out to me.
I can see why.
I dig it. I liked the attack on Ascalante. And let's see, upon him crouched a great black thing, which he knew was born in no sane or human world. Its slavering black fangs were near his throat, and the glare of its yellow eyes shriveled his limbs as a killing wind shrivels young corn. Then Ascalante's cynical and all-sufficient philosophy deserted him. Like, he's full of himself even in this moment, until he's not. And with a ghastly cry, he gave up the ghost before the slavering fangs touched him. And that's what Thothamon said. Blast his soul. Send him to hell before you rip his throat out.
Love it.
Very cool. Metal.
Feels this good to is be a, back. This is a visceral story, too. Where, mm-hmm. Let's wrap it up. There's a lot of blood and guts. There's a lot of blood and thunder, mm-hmm. in this story. There's brain spattering. There's a lot of intrigue, a lot of talking. This has got it all, man. So... yeah, it's so good.
Yeah. I think we could talk a lot more about it, but I guess we probably shouldn't.
Maybe we'll come back to it.
Maybe.
We have a whole year.
We got a whole decade before we come back to the third time around.
I will say that in previous seasons, when we've gone back to Conan to talk about him, like the Black Stranger with Rusty Burke, uh-huh. and when we talked about The God in the Bowl with Mark, like, I didn't want those conversations to end. And now I'm pretty relieved that we get to talk about Conan for a long time.
Yeah, man. Damn near a whole year.
Where do we go next?
Frost Giant's Daughter, right?
Frost Giant's Daughter.
That's a good one.
It's a funky story. It's a good talker. There's a lot to digest for such a short little vignette. This is a much longer story, but if you're reading along and you ain't read it before, bust it out.
Mm-hmm.
Check it out.
Some good comics adaptations of it out there.
That's right.
There are.
The Dark Horse, especially. Mm-hmm. And I can't wait to delve into the mythology and correct myself next time from the mistakes that I inevitably made tonight.
You're all good, dude. we make no mistakes.
Wizard is never late.
Oh, man. We're precisely on time and we're precisely wrong.
Doing what we want.
And never dead.
About 50% of the time. Josh. How can good people find our show?
Good people of Aquilonia. Direct your browsers to thecromcast.blogspot.com. King Conan would also remind you that we are on Twitter @thecromcast, Instagram @thecromcast, and Facebook @thecromcast. You can call us 859-429-CROM, just as Thothamon called a demonic mandrel from beyond the veil.
And you can email number requires less blood.
A little bit.
Yeah.
And you can email us, thecromcast@gmail.com.
We'll see you in the frozen wastes here in a little bit when we meet the Frost Giant's Daughter. And we hope you're excited for all this good, delicious Conan content.
It's the good good.
It's the good good.
It's the good good.